And we will move to the fourth case this morning, which is case number 092308, Jesse Webster versus the United States. Ms. Amundson.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Jessica Amundson for Appellant Jesse Webster. There is no dispute in this case that a juror was absent during one of the days of scheduled deliberations in Mr. Webster's trial. The only dispute is whether the remaining 11 jurors nonetheless deliberated in his absence, and the record evidence overwhelmingly shows that they did. As even the district court recognized, the law is clear that deliberations with fewer than 12 jurors, without the consent of the defendant and without a finding of good cause, requires reversal of Mr. Webster's conviction.
Well, I'm not so sure that it is clear that constitutes a structural error. But that's the sort of end game analysis here. So maybe we can put that off for a few minutes and talk about the fact finding that the lower court engaged in about whether the jury did or did not deliberate with only 11 in the absence of that 12th juror who had apparently called in sick. That much is clear.
Sure, Your Honor. I'd like to point out first that the district court made those findings of fact only within the context of deciding Mr. Webster's separate motion for fraud upon the court. It's clear that the district court made no findings with respect to the Section 2255 claim.
That was a mistake as well, because the judge thought that that claim was not being asserted in connection with the 2255 motion when it plainly was.
That's right,
Your
Honor.
And had not been withdrawn. So what are we supposed to do with that? Is the fact finding that was done in connection with the fraud on the court transferable to the 2255 context here?
Well, we believe it does not require any deference from this court because it was not made under the proper legal standard. However, even assuming that in the course of making that finding with respect to the fraud motion, the court did find that Mr. Webster had not proven that the jury deliberated in the absence of a juror, and we believe that that finding was clearly erroneous in any event. So there are several reasons that was clearly erroneous. The court relied primarily, actually exclusively, on custom and practice in finding that it would have been the custom and practice in his courtroom to have sent the jurors home if a juror was absent. But Mr. Webster also presented undisputed testimony about custom and practice, and that was testimony that if a juror had been absent, counsel would have been called in, it would have been put on the record, and there would have been some sort of transcript made, docket entry made, et cetera, of the jury being sent home. Secondly, not a single juror remembers being sent home. That's the one thing that the jurors who are interviewed are actually unanimous on, is the fact that they were never sent home early on any day due to the absence of a juror.
Given their other testimony, which conflicts wildly with each other and with facts that are indisputable, does the fact that they agree on that deserve any special weight?
Well, it is the one thing that they are unanimous upon, Your Honor. And in light of the other facts that are here as well, which are the docket entry, and then there's also the timing. I think it's critical here to think about the timing of this entire trial. The jury was selected on November 15th, which is a Wednesday. There's a four-day trial, Thursday, Friday, Monday, Tuesday. They then deliberate for a day on a Wednesday, the 22nd, which is the day before Thanksgiving. They're unable to reach a verdict on the day before Thanksgiving. They come back an entire week later on the 29th, and that's the day that the juror is actually absent. They then, the docket says that they are coming back at 10:30 on Thursday, and they reach a verdict almost immediately. Mr. Webster is brought from the MCC by 11:30 that morning, and the verdict is read into the record by noon. It's very difficult to understand how they could have reached a verdict in less than an hour on Thursday morning when they had not been together for more than a week and had not been able to reach a verdict on the day before Thanksgiving.
Ms. Amundson, let me raise a concern that I have with you about the fact-finding more generally, and that is whether an awful lot of this evidence really should never have been sought from jurors in light of Evidence Rule 606B, exploring the what was and was not said or done during deliberations.
Well, Your Honor, I believe that 606B does preclude testimony or inquiry into the actual deliberative process. So, for example, the breakdown of the jurors or what they were discussing, et cetera. However, it does not preclude testimony or evidence about historical objective facts of deliberation. And here that's what we're talking about, or whether or not a juror was present or absent.
The committee records and congressional records about 606B seem to indicate, for example, a juror could not testify about whether another juror was under the influence of alcohol or asleep or withdrawing from deliberations. Would you agree with that?
I would agree with that, Your Honor, that where you're inquiring into what's actually happening in the deliberation room and where you would have to have some sort of inquiry about the influence of particular jurors on a deliberative process.
How
but
is
here,
this different?
Here, there's the objective fact that a juror is actually not there for the entirety of a day during
deliberations. But how do we know whether other jurors were actually even deliberating without breaching that wall under Rule 606B?
I believe that would just be a historical fact. Did deliberations take place? And the district court did, and the parties agreed upon a definition of deliberations that would be read to the jurors before they were asked about what actually occurred that day. So,
how does this case differ from, let's say, a juror who takes an extended bathroom or smoking break or simply retreats to a corner while the other 11 discuss the case without him?
Again, Your Honor, I believe that there the inquiry would have to be as to what was actually happening in the deliberative process.
Well,
here the inquiry is as to a historical fact that a juror was not there. And you can't say that it's cured simply by the fact that the juror showed up on the last day and voted with them. If that were the case, then jurors could just sort of come and go as they pleased from deliberations.
We know this is not an ideal situation here, but we do have this problem of, as Judge Sykes was mentioning, of wondering whether this is really structural in light of, for example, the potential for jurors to disengage or to disappear for a time.
Well, I think that the bright line rule is that where you would have to inquire into the actual deliberative process and the influence of certain jurors, that under 606B is not something that you can undertake. However, you can inquire into the historical fact of deliberations. And as to Judge Sykes' original question about structural error, every court that has considered the issue, including this court in the Araujo case, has concluded that allowing 11 jurors to proceed without a finding of good cause and without the consent of the defendant is structural error that requires reversal without a showing of prejudice. And
isn't that in a context where the verdict is actually returned by only 11, opposed to what we have here, where the verdict clearly was returned by the 12 sworn jurors?
That's correct, Your Honor, but the plain text of Rule 23 is not so limited to just verdicts being rendered by jurors. Moreover, if that were the case, it would mean that jurors could simply come and go from deliberations as they please, or they could decide at the outset that two of you are going to decide this case for us and the rest of us are going across the street to have lunch and then show up and vote, and that would somehow cure the prejudice. That does not seem like a tenable rule, nor does it seem like what the Sixth Amendment is intended to protect.
Isn't there an oath administered to the bailiff before the jury is sent to commence deliberations to keep the jurors assembled together unless otherwise ordered by the court?
I'm not aware of that, Your Honor, and it does not appear in the record, but that may very well be.
It's pretty routine.
An oath is given in every trial.
I've heard it a few hundred times.
One of the issues here, Your Honor, is that the bailiff needs to have right.
They don't escape.
Right. And so, and that is the issue here, is that a juror did escape, Your Honor. That a juror somehow fell through the cracks. That a juror had not shown up for that day.
He called in, said he was ill.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. That's
conceded.
Well,
then he didn't fall through the cracks. Everybody knew he wasn't.
Well, what fell through the cracks is that the jurors went ahead and deliberated in his absence, that no juror recalls being sent home, that the docket entry says that jury trial was held that day, and there's this court and every court accords a presumption of correctness to the docket trial entries. And here the government did not put on any evidence that showed that the docket entry was incorrect. The only thing that is weighing in the balance on the district court and the government side is custom and practice in the courtroom. But as I said, there's custom and practice equally on the other side that says that a record would have been made of this. The jurors are unanimous that they weren't sent home early. The counsel and Mr. Webster were not brought into the courtroom for any consultation about whether to proceed with only 11 jurors or whether to send the jurors home. And although the jurors were not specifically asked anything about deliberations, four jurors did spontaneously volunteer that there were 2 days of deliberations, which would be consistent with the fact that they deliberated on both of those Wednesdays.
So the jury didn't come back until 10:30 on the Thursday after Thanksgiving?
That's correct, Your Honor. And the Mr. Webster was notified shortly thereafter that they had reached a verdict. He had to be brought over from the MCC. The record shows that he was brought over by 11:30 that morning, and the verdict was read into the record at noon on that Thursday. So it's very hard to understand how they – excuse me?
What's the travel time?
I don't know that, Your Honor.
Finding somebody in the MCC can take a little time.
That's correct, Your Honor. And he, of course, had to be dressed to be brought to court. So to think that that all happened in less than an hour when the jurors had not been together for more than a week at that point, and presumably the jurors would have been anxious to conclude their jury service on the day before Thanksgiving rather than having to come back a week after. Moreover, the jurors actually acquitted him of the only substantive count. He was convicted only of conspiracy and attempt as to the drug counts. He was actually acquitted as to the possession with intent count. So clearly there must have been some sort of debate that took place in these deliberations. I'd like to turn to the government's main arguments, which are that Mr. Webster waived the claim that he originally brought in his 2255 petition by pursuing it in alternate forms. The government is attempting to defend the district court's clear error in not deciding Mr. Webster's 2255 petition by stating that it actually chose to address it in the form that he finally brought it, which was a separate motion for fraud upon the court. But the record actually demonstrates that Mr. Webster both pursued and continued to make his Section 2255 claim at every stage of the proceedings. If the court looks in the record at Docket Entry 50, which is one of the last briefs that Mr. Webster filed following the evidentiary hearing in this case, Mr. Webster clearly referred only to his claim as a violation of Rule 23 and of the Sixth Amendment and made no mention of either the fraud claim or the ineffective assistance of counsel claim. And it's also critical to look at how the government treated that claim. In the very last filing that the government made with this court, they refer to Mr. Webster's jury claim as the primary claim in his Section 2255 petition. So the government below never treated Mr. Webster's claim as waived. It's only here on appeal that they are arguing waiver for the first time. And as to their fallback claim that Mr. Webster's claim was facially insufficient, their briefing below never took issue with the facial insufficiency of his claim either. If the court has no further questions, I see that I'm in my rebuttal time.
Thank you. Mr. Eldon.
May it please the court, the district court found that the defendant failed to prove his claim that a jury of only 11 deliberated on one of the days. That finding was reasonable, and therefore we ask the court to affirm. I'd like to go directly to the merits of the defendant's claim, which is based on the assertion that on one of the days, only 11 members of the jury deliberated. The district court found that the defendant had not proved that claim. The district court's verdict was not proven. I admit that was a reasonable conclusion. This is one of those cases where, because of the state of the record, neither side could conclusively prove what actually happened. And inevitably, as occurred here, the party with the burden of proof lost. In a Section 2255 proceeding, the defendant has the burden of proof. And the reason the evidence was not conclusive on as to what actually happened is because the courtroom security officer who would have known exactly what happened was deceased. The court reporter's notes were incomplete. Even after the evidentiary hearing, defense counsel was still attempting to get jurors' notes that could have shown something occurring on the day in question in the courtroom and could not obtain those jury notes. So the jury notes were incomplete. The jurors were interviewed, but their answers and memories were all over the map.
Before you proceed with that, what was the reason why the court reporter's notes were unavailable or incomplete?
I don't know. I don't know what the reason was. The court reporter just told us that the court reporter could not give us notes for the period of time. I don't know why the court reporter could not do that.
No reason was offered?
Your Honor, I don't recall if there was a reason. If there was a reason, I don't recall what it was. But by the time that this was about 10 years after the events, and we could not obtain, and defense counsel could not obtain, court reporter notes for the day in question, November 29th, 1995.
And there's no record in the docket of any on-the-record proceedings that day?
The only docket entry is jury trial held continued to November 30th. That's the only docket entry. And that docket entry was made a week after. It was made on December, I believe it was December 5th, about a week after the day that the docket entry concerned. And there was stipulated testimony by the court's clerk as to the fact that the clerk, a week afterwards, made several entries. In other words, after the trial was all over, after the weekend had passed, the clerk sat down and made some entries regarding the trial, and each one was basically the same. Jury trial held continued to the next day. And the defense tries to make much of that one little entry, jury trial held. But the entry jury trial held does not say the jury deliberated. And we would respectfully submit that you cannot draw the inference from jury trial held that the jury deliberated. And the reason I say that is because the clerk was the person who made the entry. And the clerk testified, through stipulated testimony, that he believed the jury did not deliberate.
Based on what?
Based on custom and practice. But the point is,
the jury trial held designation means the jury did not deliberate?
That's right. He was not trying to say when he entered that.
Of course, that's what they used to pay the jurors.
That's right. I mean, the jurors that arrived, I'm sure were paid for that day.
I bet they were.
Yes. And
what designation does the clerk use when the jury is deliberating?
I don't think, Your Honor, I have not encountered
deliberations continue.
Jury trial held even when the jury's not deliberating, when they're taking testimony.
Right.
In other words, that there were proceedings.
Right, but
and
does,
this
the,
is a jury
does the
trial.
Clerk have a contrary designation for when the jury is actually deliberating? So instead of jury trial held,
never seen
the clerk's
one,
designation is deliberations continue?
I've never seen one. I've never seen anything of that. Of
that's
of
what
that
I've seen. That's what I've used.
Well, I have
to distinguish between the trial ongoing and the deliberations ongoing.
That may well be true. But if you look at the docket entries in this case, what the clerk did is just a jury trial held continue the next day. Whether it was testimony, deliberations, opening statement, closing argument, whatever it was. And therefore, that's why we say...
Well, we know it wasn't the trial, right? Because the trial, the evidentiary phase of the trial had concluded, closing arguments were done, the jury had been charged, the case had been submitted to the jury.
So. Right, but when the clerk, after the fact, just put those in there to indicate that there were there were proceedings. But the clerk was not trying to say. Now, if I write in my brief, you know, jury trial held, and you say, well, Mr. Elder, you're saying that the jury deliberated, and I'm saying, no, that's not what I'm trying to say. I can tell you what I was trying to say. And what the clerk told us what he was trying to say, what he was not trying to say, because he said he believed the jury did not deliberate, and whatever that was based on. The question is what was the intent of the clerk in writing that in? And that's why what we're saying is that entry, which was basically a perfunctory entry made after the fact in connection with all the other entries, he made several of the entries for the trial all at the same time.
Is it not reasonable to suppose that the clerk would have entered in the docket for that November 29th date, jury sent home, if that was Judge Zagel's practice when there was a sick juror and
that,
no deliberations could be
that
held?
That might very well have been. That might have been something that could have been done, should have been done, it would have been done in other cases. I'm not denying that would have certainly been. In this case, we wouldn't be here right now if that entry had been made. But the question is, when the clerk made the entry that he did make, what did he mean? And we know he didn't mean to say that the jury deliberated because he testified. I didn't believe the jury did deliberate. So you cannot draw from what he wrote in there that the jury deliberated. And that's why we're saying that it's a perfunctory entry that does not advance the inquiry.
Well, the clerk's testimony was not based on any personal recollection of the events, right?
It was not based on eyewitness testimony. He said he remembered the case.
And he remembered the jury being sent home on that day?
No. Well, he said he believed the jury was sent home. But he did not witness it. He did not witness.
Extrapolating from the judge's standard practice, not because he remembered the jury had been sent home.
Yes, the jury, walk out. I mean, because that was part of the
testimony. Whether he witnessed it or not, he didn't testify that he recalled that the jury was sent home that day.
He said he based his belief on custom and practice. That was the testimony.
What I'm trying to get at here is the bottom line is that the entire fact finding in this case, to the extent that it was made in connection with the fraud on the court claim, was a fact finding based on custom and practice.
Yes, but here's the point, Judge. What the district court said is his verdict was not proven. His verdict was that the defendant had not proved it. And because of the ambiguity of the docket entry, and the fact that the attorneys didn't remember exactly what happened, the courtroom security officer was deceased. The custom and practice was important, and because that did offset it. But he's not saying he did not say that the government affirmatively proved. So he's saying it was not proved. And although it was in connection with the fraud on the court claim, and by the way, that claim, there was a separate motion, but that claim was in the 2255 as well. The defendant amended his 2255 to include that claim. So whenever the fraud on the court claim is talked about, it's part of the 2255 and the separate motion. And although, Your Honor, the district court addressed the question of did 11 jurors deliberate in connection with the fraud on the court claim, it's the same issue. It's the same factual issue. In other words, the district court addressed the substance of the claim that only 11 jurors deliberate. In other words, the claim that the defendants say was in the original 2255 position. The district court addressed the substance of that claim. He addressed whether or not 11 or more jurors deliberated. And he said the defendants had not proved it. He didn't use any special burden of proof.
Mr. Eldon?
Yes.
Do you think it was appropriate to interrogate jurors about the events of that day?
Your Honor, the government objected to that initially, and our objections were overruled. I think in this context, whether a juror deliberates or not, whether a juror is not a proper subject for inquiry under Rule 606B. In other words, a juror might – this is a case where a juror was sick. And we say there's – and we do not say there was deliberations on that day. But a juror is sick. One of the jurors doesn't deliberate. Well, maybe a juror goes in the bathroom and says, I'm staying in the bathroom and I'm not talking to you folks anymore. All right? That's not a subject that you could
inquire. Such rumors do occasionally leak into the judge's chambers. Yes.
Yeah. And Judge, we cite some cases in our brief where there were brief absences of jurors for whatever reason. One of them was a juror was in the washroom. One of them was there was a family matter that one of the jurors had to take care of. And what the courts held there is that you could not inquire into those matters under Rule 606B. And although the district judge in this case allowed it, if you read the footnote, he says, I don't think I'm ever going to do this again. So the point is, and that's why we say this is not a structural error, because whether the juror deliberates or not, you would have to look at the entire circumstances of the situation to determine whether or not the defendant was deprived of a fair trial. It wouldn't be automatic just because a juror isn't there for a piece of the deliberations.
Well, it sounds like it was half of the deliberations if the jury did deliberate on the 29th.
Well, what we're saying, it was not proved. The district court found it was not proved.
You lose on that.
I beg your pardon?
Let's assume you're losing on that.
Well, that the jury deliberated on that day?
Then this juror is missing for half the deliberations, because it sounds like the jury was at it for maybe a half an hour at most on Thursday morning.
I don't know the exact times of the deliberations, Judge, but there was no juror, by the way. There were jurors who said that that we deliberated. There was never a time when we deliberated with less than 12. There were jurors who said that. There's never a juror who said that they deliberated with less than 12. No juror so remembered it. But as the district court found, with the many...
I thought the testimony of the investigator was that the jurors didn't recall. And at most, was that they were never sent
one
home.
One juror stated that they did not... deliberate with less than 12. That at no time did they deliberate with less than 12.
And everybody else said they didn't recall somebody being absent during deliberations?
No one recalled anyone being absent during deliberations. In other words, there was some question someone said that, well, there was a juror absent, but then there was an alternate put in, which was incorrect. But that would only be a situation where, but at no time was there a deliberation of less than 12. But the point is that the district court did address the substance of the defendant's claim and made we submit a reasonable finding. And the fact that the district court addressed it in the context of fraud on the court, we submit that fault lies with the defendant, not with the court, because that's the way the defendant presented the matter to the district court. At the hearing, the defendant claims that there was a problem with the hearing. We submit the defendant received a fair hearing in this matter, was not restricted in any way from calling any witnesses that he might have wanted to call. and did not and the district court did not deny the defendant any request made by the defendant to call any particular witnesses at the evidentiary hearing or present any evidence at the evidentiary hearing. And therefore, we would submit that the defendant received a fair hearing. The district court's findings were reasonable. And therefore, we respectfully request this court to affirm.
Thank you. Ms. Amundson, how much time? You have 2.5 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a few points in response to some of Your Honor's questions. First, as to the docket entries, I would encourage the court to look at A14 of the short appendix that is submitted with the brief, to look at the docket entries, which are on the 22nd, which is the date that the jurors indisputably deliberated. Jury trial held is the exact same entry that is then repeated on the 29th, which is the date that is in dispute.
Was the case submitted to the jury that morning or the day before?
The case was submitted to the jury the evening of the 21st, and that has also the same entry of jury trial held. Moreover, it's not simply the defendant's contention that the docket entry says that the jurors deliberated that day. That was actually the district court's finding. And so the district court, which would obviously be familiar with what its docket entries typically mean, says that these docket entries indicated jury trial or that the jury deliberated. Testimony as to custom and practice that Your Honor was asking about, the court security officer, it was based purely on custom and practice. He had no recollection of the jurors being sent home that day. And in fact, Mr. Webster presented undisputed testimony on custom and practice that in his experience in Judge Zagel's courtroom, that counsel would have been called in and the matter would have been put on the record had the jury been sent home for the day. Neither the government nor Judge Zagel ever disputed that testimony. So at most, you have custom and practice weighing on both sides of the balance. As to the question Your Honor asked about whether the jurors recalled deliberating with less than 12, Mr. Eldon repeatedly said that no juror recalled deliberating with less than 12. I would refer the court to page 14 of our brief where the questions that were asked to the juror are listed. The jurors were specifically not asked anything about their deliberations. They're only asked about the absence of the juror. So for the government or the district court to say no juror recalled deliberating with less than 12 jurors, they were not asked that question. They may just as well have been asked, or they may just as well assert no juror recalled what the weather was that day. They were not asked that question. And the investigator specifically said that he was instructed to stay on the paper and to ask only the questions that were submitted to him by the judge.
So to the extent that the district court based its decision on that fact, it's not substantiated in the record because they weren't specifically asked that.
That's exactly right, Your Honor. There's no basis for it at all. One juror did spontaneously state that he did not recall deliberations with less than 12 jurors, but that was not a question that any of the jurors were specifically asked. The question that they were specifically asked was there ever a date upon which you were sent home without because of the absence of a juror? Every single one of them said no. Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Our thanks to all counsel and Ms. Amundson. You took this case on appointment from the court, is that right? And you